thank you. I was humbled to be asked to speak and to be in such august company. I love to talk, and let's see. I'm a neurotic narcissist, if I have to identify myself as anything. I do qualify to be here. I've been involved with AA for about 30 years, and I'm 12 years sober now. And the first, I guess, from the age of about 14 to until I guess the 1980s, I smoked a lot of pot and was using intravenous drugs, and I've been and I did drink. I mean, I ended up drinking quite a bit, but it was never my thing. I could never. I'm a child with some European heritage. My father was from Yugoslavia, and they felt that you should introduce children to alcohol, but I could never believe that they were drinking scotch. I took a sip of scotch and I said, there's no way you guys are deliberately drinking this. And they put ice in it, which is a high crime in my opinion. But I spent about 4 years all told in live-in drug rehabs, the first starting when I was 15. And I've been exposed to almost any kind of therapeutic situation that you can imagine. Psychiatry, you know, Jungian, Freudian, social workers, you know, you name it. In the drug programs, they use what's called the encounter modality of therapy, where you sit in a group with a room of people. I mean, I sit in a room full of people, and I'll be talking like I am now, and then someone across the room will say, why don't the fuck you be honest for once in your life? And so it's quite different from the sort of quiet, reserved atmosphere of an AA meeting. But I think I've come to really respect that type of thing, because in the end, it's not what I say or what somebody else says, but really what I decide to do and how I think and how I feel. I used to do a lot of speaking at non-agnostic AA groups, and it was always so funny because the first thing I would always say was, I love AA. It's just the people in the meetings that I can't stand. And I had the meeting out of my hand from that point on, because the truth has a way of ringing true. But in the same vein, it's more important. The truth is more important than being right. So when I stopped drinking and when I stopped taking, you know, getting bombed in one form or another, it quickly became not about that at all. And I'm the type of person that gets struck sober. I became so unhappy that I ran to get so. I mean, you couldn't pay me to get high and drink. Until that moment when, I mean, I never white knuckled it, as I've heard people say. When I heard the call, I answered it. But after maybe 12 or 15, you know, 12 incidents like that, where all of a sudden I'd drink half a bottle of Guinness and then leave it there. I remember once I was in a Chinese restaurant, and I was reading that William Saroyan said that you have to be an alcoholic to be a good writer. You have to drink to be a good writer. So I said, wow, that's that's for me. And so I got a Guinness and I drank half of it and I was able to leave and not finish it. And that proved to me that I wasn't, you know, that I didn't have a problem and that I had been creating this fantasy that I had a problem. But very quickly, in every instance, my life returned to in a period, a very short period of maybe even week, you know, short couple of weeks, where my life became just the purpose of my life became never running out of pot and drinking Guinness until I was, you know, insensate and you know, went to sleep. So I, AA was a refuge for me because I was so unhappy. And I spent most of my time in the early days where I would come to the meeting and just weep with relief. But that sense of relief started to wear off because I was hearing there was a conflict. Because here I was having left a smoking crater in my wake throughout my life. And yet I was having doctrinal differences with the people and the meetings that I was attending. It felt like I was at a party to which I was crashing a party to which I was not invited. And it felt like it's very impolite to come to someone's house for dinner and then start telling them, well, you know, the roast was overcooked and I wouldn't have served that those kind of potatoes with that. And, you know, it's very nice. But, you know, this sort of wine always gets served with that food. And so I'm being thrown a life. I'm being thrown a life preserver. And then I read that it's the White Star Line and I say, oh, well, you know, I think I'll just stay in the ocean. I don't approve of this company. But at the same time, I was admonished to be honest. Honesty, time and time again, people would say, you have to be honest. But when I was honest, the temperature in the room dropped 40 degrees, and I became the target of people who were telling me that there was no way I was going to make it with my attitude. And being a puffed up, supercilious know-it-all, I was in a room, I was in a duel of wits with unarmed opponents. And so it became, I was so relieved just to have to not be drinking and getting high that I went to meetings all the time. And it was never a decision, I'm going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. It's just that by about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I became very uncomfortable. Going to a meeting split that time, like gave me enough of a distraction so that I could finish out the day and not sort of obsess on a desire to get some pot or to have a drink. And after a while, my friends in the groups begged me to go to agnostic meetings. They said, Marco, you don't have to suffer like this. There are agnostic meetings. You can go to them. Please go to those meetings. So I did, and I've never looked back. I was home. There's been a constant harangue throughout history about theistic talk. Gods, no God, you know, but no matter what you decide to call it, the meeting point is thoughts and feelings. Thoughts and feelings. The spirit is the flesh. No matter what mountaintop you go to, you're still, what you're left with is your feelings and your ideas about whatever it is you're thinking about and feeling. And so what to do now? You know, when now, okay, now I'm sober, what do I do? I quickly found that anxiety was the main, my main problem. And I didn't know what to do about it. And I fought the idea of taking antidepressant medication for a long, 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 long time. But after trying many different things, it was amazing how it cleared up a lot of the impediments to living a fulfilling, to living a fulfilling life. And my goal now has become to be fearless and friendly. That in a vain effort to educate myself, I've amassed a huge library, and I'm a writer. I was a spoken word performance artist, and so I get a lot of help out of putting my thoughts to paper, and my journals are a big are solace, and I don't make decisions. I'm sort of, the world kind of leads me. I react to life. I've never been much help to other people or performing the role of someone who's an advisor or a helper or a big brother or a sponsor. I'm actually a spectacular failure at doing that. I mean, if you want to talk to me, okay. But I mean, I'm like a vicious Saint Bernard that has poison in the cask instead of cognac when I run to help somebody, and so also that it helped me a great deal to realize there were two things that helped me immensely. One, that my desperate need to be the center of attention was one of the culprits in why I was having such a difficult time in life. Going out to dinner with eight people used to be a harrowing, harrowing experience for me, because I experienced stark terror at not being the center of attention and to the subject of the conversation. And I would, engage in this sort of barking semaphore of, you know, trying to steer the conversation in my direction, and then being enraged that they didn't share my esteem and they didn't share my notion of my magnificence, of how terrific I was, how dare they ignore me. But trying to talk about this, there were years and years of suffering, because I never really came to grips with found a solution to the problem. And it was like carrying around a bag of shit and then coming to someone and say, here, could you hold on to this for a little while? You know? And I was expecting other people to do for me what I was supposed to do for myself. And one of the biggest tools I discovered was just to shut up and listen to what other people were talking about. Stopped. It's so simple that all I had to do was nothing. All I had to do was to listen to other people instead of anxiously waiting for my time to speak and actually ignoring what they were saying because I wanted to talk about me. I had a friend who's no longer with us, but he was sort of probably the most famous person in the world, of harp, and that's stringed harps, not harmonica, but harps, like Irish harps. But because the world of the harp is such small potatoes, nobody's ever heard of him. But he was a composer and a scholar of the first rank, and he took me under his wing and educated me. It was a truly a Pygmalion story of the first rank. And I'm a chef by trade, and I used to talk to him about what I did today, what I did. I made I made this and that, and I would become enraged because to him, I could have, instead of saying I'd made a salmon coulibiac with the beurre blanc, I had said, well, I took a box of Aunt Jemima's and added water to it and I made some pancakes. That was the level of his interest and him being impressed at what I was doing. So it offended me so much that it just, I was miserable. So my goal is, and also I've noticed that I'm going to return to the dogs because contentment is as rare in human beings as it is common in animals. And I love the way that dogs come up to somebody that they don't know. And how many times have you met a dog that, you know, it's a strange dog, there's someone's walking their dog, and they come up to you like, oh my God, he's here, hi, oh God, hello. And I sort of try to incorporate that into my life. I mean, you can't, and you can pet animals, you can give them physical attention and touch in a way that you cannot do with human beings. You can't walk up to somebody and pet them. And so I end up feeling envious in a way of that, the attention that we wantonly bequeath to animals that we so stingily hoard amongst ourselves. And so I've... I've sort of crossed the Rubicon. I no longer base a lot of my thoughts and ideas about getting high and drinking. It's like that the things to know and things to do in the world are so vast that I find I'm not that interested in recovery and AA and discussions about recovery and AA, and I'd rather be buried in an anthill, really, than to read AA literature. I've read them all. I have them on my shelves, but I move on. I'd rather read Will Durant or William James pick one. And so, to me, being happy is and finishing my work, my projects are what sustains me, and not knocking on closed doors. I mean, another of my big problems was that I would emotionally hallucinate. I could walk past someone in the street, and the thought that comes to my mind is, why don't they like me? And so it's such a relief to set that burden down, to just change that channel, because I found that these types of thoughts were almost always wrong, because everybody's got a lot of much more important things to do than wonder about me and what I'm doing. So it's been a huge help to me to, as I said, to change the channel. And the way that I stay going to AA meetings, and I could just as soon really go to NA meetings, but the reading level is higher at AA meetings, frankly. And so I prefer to go to AA meetings. And it's apparent to me that one of the things that's so powerful about AA or 12-step modality is that it throws you back upon yourself because you're the only one talking. The anonymous nature of all the people listening creates them as anonymous because they're not interacting with what you're saying. So you don't get into personal disagreements or someone disapproving or approving what you're saying. And so you end up being thrown back upon yourself. And, you know, being addicted to something is sort of like a dragon guarding its cave, you know, the treasure in the cave that the world is bent on robbing from them. And so it becomes incumbent upon me to be the steward of my own fate. What makes that interesting is that sometimes it's like being the captain of a ship that's actually steering itself in a lot of ways. I mean, the thinking and feeling are so habitual because it's an automatic, you have an automatic response. Generally, they change the course of a river by having to dynamite it so that it can go in a different direction. And the same is true with neuron pathways and the way that people think and feel. And so you're faced with building something different. That's for me what I do is that now I work on the things that I love. I have attention deficit, hypertension, and so I generally don't finish things that I start. And so it's my goal to just, you know, work on myself, work on my projects, do my, you know, study, read, write. I've left many careers. My friends used to say I have a great future behind me. I've left a lot of careers. I mean, I could have had a career in any number of things, but it's like the next shiny bauble attracts my attention, and so I go and do that. And the years progress. You know, you get older sitting in a chair no matter what you do. And eventually I start to count the grains of sand going through the hourglass and it becomes more valuable and people become more valuable to me too. And the goal for me is to just be nicer, not be such a know-it-all. And I guess I think that brings me to the end of my tale, but I'm really happy to have been asked to speak. Thank you so much.